This is Alan Cooper, Elaine Ravitch Professor of Jewish Studies and Provost of the Jewish Theological Seminary, with some thoughts on one aspect of the Festival of Sukkot. Last month, an op-ed appeared in the New York Times under the title Awe, A.W., Wilderness, an obvious play on the title of Eugene O'Neill's play, Ah, Wilderness. While O'Neill's so-called wilderness actually was a town in Connecticut, the op-ed was about the real thing, recalling the sad incident of a skier who got lost on a trail in northern Minnesota and died of exposure. In response to the tragedy, the Forest Service installed markers along the trail. But when the time came to replace them, the agency refused to do so, claiming that the signs violated the 1964 Wilderness Act. The article went on to discuss the problematic balance between preserving wilderness areas and providing safe access to them. An interpretation of the Wilderness Act tilted in favor of preservation led to the banning not only of signs, but also of vehicles and tools that might facilitate access and improve safety. As a result, the author observed, the agencies have made supposedly open recreational areas inaccessible and even dangerous, putting themselves in opposition to healthy and environmentally sound activities, the very thing Congress intended the Wilderness Act to promote. In response to the article, one correspondent wrote that the author had a very different concept of wilderness than many of us. We want places where safety and survival are not guaranteed, and I'm willing to accept the risk inherent in visiting them. As another put it, there must remain parts of our world that are true wilderness, without the safeguards and conveniences of the modern world. Lives are lost in such places as lives are lost in the larger world, but it is nonetheless good to rely solely on ourselves when we go there. It might be, with Sukkot on my mind, the wilderness controversy prompted me to imagine what the Israelites' experience of the wilderness might be like nowadays, in contrast to biblical times. How much of the hardship of their 40-year trek from Egypt to Canaan might they have been spared if their four-wheel drive, instead of four-legged drive vehicles, had been guided by GPS rather than by meandering pillars of fire and cloud, or if the signage in the desert had amounted to more than a few indecipherable graffiti, even more obscure than Garden State Parkway markers. Leaving those idle notions aside, however, I noted a striking parallel between the opposing views of wilderness, greater safety versus greater risk, and varying degrees of Sukkot observance. It is well known that biblical law assigns more than one connotation to the festival. While it was primarily the Israelite harvest celebration, probably derived from an old Canaanite festival, it was secondarily historicized in relation to the Exodus, acquiring an additional dimension of meaning, according to Leviticus chapter 23, verses 42 to 43, which I quote, "You shall live in booths 7 days. All citizens in Israel shall live in booths, Sukkot, in order that future generations may know that I made the Israelite people live in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt, I, the Lord your God." We observe the historical aspect of the festival by erecting and living in our own Sukkot, ritually identifying with our ancestors' sojourn in the wilderness, just as we revisit the thrill of liberation from Egyptian slavery at our Pesach Sidarim. We also endure some of the vicissitudes of the wilderness in our Sukkot. But exactly what does it mean to live in the Sukkah? And what sort of wilderness do we experience in a nicely appointed backyard hut? In Talmudic times, people apparently inhabited the Sukkah for the duration of the festival, taking all their meals in it and even sleeping in it. Some Jews continue that stringent practice to the present day. But the halakha does not demand it, especially not of those who live in colder climates. Observance of Sukkot is supposed to be a source of enjoyment, not discomfort. See Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 14. One frigid sleepover in a Connecticut Sukkah many years ago was more than enough to convince me of the wisdom of the halakha. The essential halachic requirement is to eat all full meals, that means meals in which we take bread, in the sukkah. But even that requirement is weather dependent. We do not have to eat in the sukkah if it is raining or snowing, which actually happened to us one year. Nevertheless, as Rabbi Louis Jacob, Zichrono Levracha, observes, it is the custom of the majority of Hasidim to stay in the sukkah even when it is raining. Rabbi Jacobs explains their rationale. While there is no obligation to stay in the sukkah during inclement weather because of the discomfort involved, a true Hasid never experiences discomfort in the fulfillment of a mitzvah. The Hasidic attitude partially parallels the view of one of the letter writers I cited above. There must remain parts of our world that are true wilderness, without the safeguards and conveniences of the modern world. The more unforgiving the conditions in our sukkah, perhaps, the greater the empathy we experience with the harsh lives of our ancestors. But when the letter goes on to state that it is, quote, good to rely solely on ourselves, end of quote, it expresses a sentiment that is diametrically opposed to one of the fundamental teachings of Sukkot. No matter how remote our locale or how dire our situation, we are never truly alone, and there is no particular virtue in relying solely on ourselves. While the mainstream interpretation has taken the sukkah to be a physical structure, rabbinic literature also provides an alternative in the name of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Eliezer says, they were real sukkot. Rabbi Akiva says, the sukkot were the clouds of glory in the Sifra Emor, 1711, and parallels. In a fine article entitled The Symbolism of the Sukkah, which appeared in Judaism, Volume 43, published in 1994, JTS grad school alumnus and now NYU professor Jeffrey L. Rubinstein explains, for Rabbi Eliezer, the Israelites dwelled in real booths in the desert. For Rabbi Akiva, however, the Israelites did not reside in booths at all. They dwelled midst the clouds of glory, within the clouds that mark the presence and radiance of God. Rubinstein understands that the two interpretations, realistic and symbolic, are complementary rather than contradictory. As he rightly observes, rituals and symbols operate on many levels and have many meanings. The beautiful image of clouds of glory surrounding and enveloping the Israelite camp evokes God's protective and loving presence amidst hardship. Whether the danger is existential, as it was for the unfortunate skier in Minnesota and for the Israelites in the wilderness, or ritualized, as when we brave the wasps and risk exposure in our Sukkot, God is present. Overarching the fragile physical sukkah that is exposed to the elements is God's sukkat shalom, the canopy of security that we invoke every evening in prayer. Through observance and prayer, we may transform the transitory experience of divine protection in our ritual wilderness into a permanent condition of dwelling, as Psalm 91 verse 1 puts it, in the shelter of the Most High. Shabbat shalom u'moadim l'simcha.